I'd like to let you know that Aussie Meter is sponsored by OPC Health, an Australian supplier of prosthetics, orthotics, clinic equipment, compression garments, rehabilitation devices for doctors, physiotherapists, orthotists, podiatrists, and hand therapists. If you'd like to know what OPC Health offers, visit opchealth.com.au and view their range online. Good day and welcome to the Aussie Med Ed, the Australian Medical Education Podcast, where we get to interview specialists in a variety of medical areas, asking their opinion on their certain conditions, obtaining their insight into how they diagnose and treat that condition. In these COVID times, it's a way of replacing the relaxed discussion around the hospital by allowing the listener to put forward questions to be answered or addressed on their behalf. I hope you enjoy the whole program, and welcome once again to Aussie Med Ed. And in this episode, we get to speak to Dr. Christine Lai. Christine's a general surgeon with a post-fellowship training in both breast surgery and endocrine surgery, and she's heavily involved in teaching at the University of Adelaide and also the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. She's going to give us her perspective on breast cancer. Not only would this information be useful for the general practitioner seeing a patient on a regular basis, but also for the medical student revising for their exams or preparing for their OSCE examination. I'm Gavin Nyman. I'm an orthopaedic surgeon based in Adelaide in South Australia and a senior lecturer at the University of Adelaide. And I'm the host of this podcast. Remember that if you like the podcast, please don't hesitate to share it with your friends or give us a review on Apple or on Spotify. I'd like to begin this podcast by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which this podcast has been produced and pay my respects to the elders both past and present. And in this episode of Aussie Med Ed, we speak to Dr. Christine Lai. She's a specialist general surgeon with post-fellowship training in the subspecialty fields of breast and endocrine surgery. She's a clinical senior lecturer at the University of Adelaide and a staff specialist at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital Breast and Endocrine Surgical Unit. Well, today we've got Christine Lai on the phone. Christine, you're going to talk to us about your experience with breast cancer. And it's nice to have you on board. Thanks very much for coming on today, Christine.
Thanks very much for having me on, Gav. It's a real honour and pleasure to be here to chat about breast cancer, which is one of the common issues that I deal with on a day-to-day basis in my clinical practice.
I believe it's one of the most common cancers affecting females.
Yes. It is one of the most common cancers affecting women, particularly women who are postmenopausal. With the screening program, we are picking up more women with very early breast cancers and being able to treat them at such an early stage that we invariably end up curing them from their breast cancer.
But does it only affect females or do you get it in guys as well?
We do have men who are diagnosed with breast cancer, although it's much less common. Less than 1% of all people diagnosed with breast cancer are men. So it is overwhelmingly a female problem, but certainly something that can't be discounted in a man who presents with a hard mass in the retroareolar region or who presents with nipple discharge. So they're definitely things that we have to consider if a man presents with symptoms in their breast.
Is there any one type of breast cancer or do you classify it into different areas?
Interestingly, we do have different types of breast cancer, Gav, and the most common way of diagnosing types of breast cancer is based on the histopathological findings. So there is ductal carcinoma in situ, which is a non-invasive type of breast cancer where there are malignant cells in the duct, but they haven't actually spread through the basement membrane and invaded through the surrounding tissue. So they don't behave like a true cancer because the cells don't metastasize because they haven't developed that ability to do it. An invasive breast cancer, and the most common type of invasive breast cancer is ductal carcinoma, which represents 80% of all invasive breast cancers. Lobular carcinoma, it represents 10% of invasive cancers, and then you've got the special types of breast cancer, including medullary, mucinous, capillary and tubular carcinomas of the breast. But we also categorise breast cancer according to immunohistochemical status. So when I say that, I talk about the testing that the pathologists do to see if the tumour cells express the estrogen receptor, the progesterone receptor, the HER2 receptor or not. And the reason why this is important is that it's important for therapy of breast cancer. So there's luminal A, which the cells have estrogen receptor positivity and HER2 receptor negativity, and they are cells which exhibits low proliferation, so they're usually low-grade cancers. They represent 40 to 55% of all breast cancers diagnosed. There's luminal B, which is estrogen receptor positive and HER2 receptor negative, but the cells are dividing and proliferating at a high rate. And then there's the HER2 positive group, which they have HER2 positive status for their receptor testing, and they represent 20% of the breast cancers which are diagnosed in our communities around the world. And then 15% of all breast cancers are basal-like breast cancers or triple negative, where they don't express any of the hormone receptors of estrogen or progesterone or are HER2 receptor negative.
So this second classification is more of a functional receptor classification. Was the first one more an anatomical classification? Does it still have the same type of cell type in it, or is it different cell types in that first anatomical type classification?
First type looks at the cell, and so you're right, it is an anatomical classification. So there are lobular cells or cells which have a medullary pattern, or ductal cells which have a medullary pattern, ductal cells which form a papillary pattern, so they look frond-like under a microscope, or a tubular pattern, or mucinous, where they secrete mucin, and lobular carcinoma cells which come from the lobules.
Is it possible that there could be a different types of estrogen and the receptors on these cancer cells might be different to the standard estrogen receptors, say, in the rest of the body, and therefore immunotherapy might be a possibility in years to come?
So I think the estrogen receptors, my understanding as a surgeon, and you probably need to speak to a clever pathologist, is that the estrogen receptors are still the same. So I don't think it would affect immunotherapy per se. I think immunotherapy more looks at the molecular pathways of cancer proliferation outside of the hormone receptors. But certainly if a breast cell expresses an estrogen receptor on it, then if you use anti-estrogen treatment, that will stop the estrogen receptor promotion of the cell dividing.
Well, coming on to the cause of the breast cancer, there's some associations for the causation, one of them being the amount of estrogen that the person's been exposed to throughout their life.
So there are multiple risk factors for developing breast cancer. As we discussed, women are more likely to have breast cancer than men. So if an individual has functioning ovaries, that increases their relative risk of breast cancer by fourfold over an individual who doesn't. Increasing age, because of the fact that the ovaries have functioned for longer, early menarche, late menopause, late first pregnancy all play a role in developing breast cancer, as does taking exogenous hormone therapy, be it the oral contraceptive pill or taking hormone replacement therapy as well. And in addition, postmenopausal obesity does play a role in developing breast cancer.
And fitness as well, is that just part of the obesity issue, or is it, does general fitness also reduce the risk of cancer developing?
Physical inactivity is in its own self an independent risk factor for developing breast cancer separate to postmenopausal obesity. So that's quite interesting. And physical inactivity is a risk factor in developing all cancers.
Christine, does smoking have a factor to play in breast cancer?
I believe smoking is defined by Cancer Australia as a risk factor for all cancers, as is high alcohol consumption is a known risk factor for developing breast cancer. And also other risk factors for breast cancer include having had high-dose radiation to the chest at a young age. For example, if an individual has had lymphoma and needed mantle cell radiotherapy, that places him or her at increased risk. And also having a family history or a personal history of breast cancer is a risk factor for developing down the track.
I believe one of the big developments over the years has been this demonstration of the gene that's associated with breast cancer.
BRCA1 and BRCA2 are responsible for 80 to 90% of all familial breast cancers with a genetic predisposition. But actually, interestingly, it only represents 3 to 6% of all breast cancers. So the vast majority of breast cancers are not related to having had a genetic mutation in our community. There are other rarer genes as well. There's TP53 or Li-Fraimeni syndrome, which can cause breast cancer, and Cowden syndrome or the P10 gene can also be associated with increased risk, as well as Peutz-Jeghers syndrome or PALB2 and CDH1 can also be associated with breast cancer in those families with those genetic mutations.
And how regular are people screened for this?
So we screen women for breast cancer, whether they've had a family history of breast cancer or not. BreastScreen Australia has a screening program, and all women are invited from the age of 50 to be involved with the screening program. And the target audience is 50 to 74-year-old women. However, women under the age of 50, from the age of 40 to 49, can put their hand up and contact BreastScreen Australia, irrespective of which state they live in or territory, and ask to be involved with the screening program. And that's a mammogram every second year in which... And those women who want to participate in the screening program will be offered a free screening mammogram every second year. However, women who have strong family histories of breast cancer may be recommended to start screening from the age of 40 And if they have family members diagnosed with breast cancer under the age of 50, it may be recommended to have yearly screening mammograms. And those women who have very strong histories of breast cancer or who have a known genetic mutation in the family or who hold the genetic mutation themselves may be recommended to start screening for breast cancer at a younger age. But just having one family member or two family members with breast cancer doesn't necessarily put an individual at high risk of breast cancer, which is something which is very different to what we learnt going through medical school back in the 20th century. So it's just becoming so common that having one or two family members doesn't necessarily place you at increased risk.
Is there a role for genetic screening though?
There is a role for genetic screening, and there are some guidelines which can be found through EVICARE. What you'll find, as I mentioned before, that breast cancer is so common in our community, having one or two family members does not place a woman necessarily into the high-risk group, and more often than not, most women who have family members with breast cancer, it's a sporadic breast cancer as opposed to hereditary breast cancer, because really, of all the breast cancers diagnosed, hereditary breast cancer only represents less than 10% of all breast cancers diagnosed in our community.
So, Christine, what about the role of assessing or screening with ultrasound or MRI? I thought it might be for the patients who have more fibrotic breasts. Is that the case, or is it for other reasons?
So screening women with MRI has certainly been shown to be of benefit in those women who have a high risk family history or who have a genetic mutation or a known genetic mutation in their family, and the government has funded MRI scans for those women. However, the role for screening MRI across the population has not been established, but we do know that in selected instances where a woman might have increased breast density, not necessarily from having a fibrotic breast, but having more glandular tissue, that it is more sensitive in picking up very small breast cancers. Although at this point in time, based on the evidence, there is no evidence that I'm aware of that it is a cost-effective tool to roll out for our whole community, but there may be a role for it in a select group of women with very, very dense glandular tissue where it's very difficult for our radiologist to interpret the mammogram. Using ultrasound can be beneficial in the sense that if a woman has symptoms, it's important to do a triple assessment. So when I say that, it includes, after taking the history, a clinical examination, mammogram and an ultrasound to target the area that she has symptoms in, because there will be a small percentage of breast cancers which can't be easily seen on mammography, such as lobular carcinoma. So that will certainly add increased sensitivity to determining whether there is something present in a symptomatic area or not.
Now, the big quandary I have with breast cancer prevention is this idea of the estrogen being bad for the causation, and yet we also advocate for hormone replacement therapy. I don't quite understand, is hormone replacement therapy in or out, or is it really on a case-by-case scenario? And I understand every person's case will be different, so this shouldn't be taken as purely the only way of treating it. But in general, is hormone replacement therapy still got a role, or is it something you have a little bit concerned about?
I think the role of hormone replacement therapy will depend on why the individual needs hormone replacement therapy. So there may be some instances where the woman has needed to take it because she's gone into early menopause in her 30s or 40s, and in which case it's not actually increasing her standard hormone exposure, because if she hadn't gone into early menopause, her ovaries would still be functioning into her late 40s and early 50s. Then there are other indications for hormone replacement therapy in a woman who's gone through menopause who has significant detriment to her quality of life, for example, the vasomotor symptoms of hot flushes, or a woman may have other issues such as migraines, etc., from hormone deprivation. So I think you're right. Every woman's case needs to be weighed up, and also her personal risk of breast cancer needs to be put into the equation as well. And then a decision needs to be made between the woman with her treating clinician as to what the overall benefit of hormone replacement therapy is versus the negative side effects. And if it's going to improve her quality of life to a point where she can function and have a good quality of life, I think that would probably outweigh the negative side effects of the potential increase of risk of breast cancer. And bearing in mind that there are multiple studies which show that HRT increases the risk of breast cancer, but there are also many studies which say that it doesn't affect one's risk of breast cancer. So given that we can screen for breast cancer, if it's going to improve a woman's quality of life, I think it would be fine to do. But also looking at the opportunity to try and withdraw HRT at regular intervals to see if it's something that woman can come off down the track, because it also does increase her risk of deep venous thrombosis and endometrial cancer as well. So there are pros and cons with taking all medications.
Now, we talked about before about the idea of a breast cancer being progestogen sensitive. Does that mean the mini pill has just as much higher risk of causing breast cancer as does the estrogen combined contraceptive pill?
Probably not. I think it's one of those things that we do test for, but in terms of the luminal classification for the management of breast cancer, we don't tend to look at the progesterone receptor status as much these days as when the testing came on board in the late 80s and early 90s.
If someone presents with a lump and they're concerned about a breast cancer, so what's the differential diagnosis in that? Are there other causes of a lump, or is it always going to be something more serious?
Absolutely. So there are plenty of causes for a woman presenting with a breast lump, and it partly depends on her age. So may present as a painless or a painful lump. There are stromal tumours which may present as masses, such as a fibroadenoma, which is the most common benign tumour of the female breast. And it generally occurs in women in their 20s and 30s. They're often multiple. They're often bilateral. They're very hormonally responsive. So they may start after taking the pill, or women may notice a lump during pregnancy. Certainly needs to be evaluated to make sure it's not a malignancy. Phalloides tumour is the other type of stromal tumour which we see, but less commonly, usually benign. More often they present in a later stage of life, in a woman's 50s, and they're often low grade and benign, but occasionally they may be borderline or high grade or malignant in nature, and we certainly get worried about a rapidly enlarging lump in a woman's breast. There are other lesions that can occur, such as myofibroblastomas or lipomas or hamartomas, which we can occasionally see in our patients who present with symptoms of breast masses. The most common presentation of a lump, and I say in quotation marks, is fibroglandular tissue, particularly in younger women, where they may notice a lumpy area, which fortunately ends up being related to their normal breast glandular tissue rather than a true breast mass.
So not every lump is of concern, but if there is one that you are concerned about, how do we go about investigating and then staging it and then treating it? What's the steps you generally tend to use?
So after taking a clinical history and doing a clinical examination, the next step is imaging. So if a woman is over the age of 40, I definitely get a mammogram and an ultrasound, plus or minus a biopsy. If a woman's under the age of 40, I then look at other factors such as, does she have a family history of breast cancer? I'll often arrange a mammogram with the individual's consent if she's over the age of 30. And if a woman's under the age of 30, I tend to just only organise an ultrasound as the first line and ask our amazing radiologist to biopsy any mass that may be present. A biopsy is important because it then gives us a cytopathological diagnosis or a histopathological diagnosis of the lesion. And from there, I can then advise the patient what the lump is due to and then also plan ongoing management if further follow-up is required or if surgery is required.
Biopsy is pretty accurate, is it?
Most biopsies are very accurate, but occasionally we might get a result which is not concordant with what we're expecting. So an example would be is if on the imaging we found a nasty-looking mass and the biopsy came back as benign, I wouldn't trust the biopsy and the radiologist had done a fine needle biopsy, or even if they'd done a core biopsy, I would discuss with the patient going back and repeating the biopsy again because we just don't want to miss a cancer. Occasionally the biopsy may show atypical or more concerning features requiring a woman to have an open biopsy, which if the open biopsy downgrades the lump to a benign lump, well then that's fantastic for the individual. But we wouldn't want to take the risk of relying on ultrasound showing a benign lump but having a discordant pathological finding showing concerning features. So it goes both ways. If it doesn't quite match up, then we'll do further tests or investigations to evaluate the lump to get a proper diagnosis.
So there's two different types of biopsies, are there? A fine needle biopsy and a core biopsy. Why would you choose one over the other?
There's multiple factors. So one being that if the lesion is a cyst, a fine needle aspiration biopsy will drain the cyst and solve the issue for the individual by removing the lump from the breast, and then the fluid will be sent off for testing. I live in South Australia and we have very well-trained cytopathologists in our state, so we know the quality of reporting is excellent, and therefore a fine needle biopsy is often used in the benign setting because it's less morbid. A core biopsy requires local anaesthesia to the skin because a cut needs to be made in the skin, and the actual coring needle is much larger than a fine needle, which is basically a blood-taking needle. So the risk of a hematoma is significantly higher using a core biopsy needle. So in the setting of an older patient who might be on blood thinners, a core biopsy generally is only done when they've come off their blood thinners. But a spine needle can be performed while the individual is still on blood thinners because it won't cause a significant hematoma, and so in which case the radiologist may choose to do that to get a diagnosis straight away rather than delay the diagnosis by waiting for the individual to come off their blood thinners and doing the biopsy at a separate occasion.
Right, so the biopsy comes back as positive, unfortunately. What's the next step? Is it a lumpectomy and nodal clearance, or is it purely a lumpectomy?
So we would generally review the imaging, and in certain circumstances you may wish to do staging with CT, a whole body bone scan, or perhaps an ultrasound of the liver, chest x-ray and blood test. And increasingly breast surgeons are using MRI to stage breast cancers to make sure that the standard mammogram and ultrasound have not missed any other tumour deposits or multifocality within the breast. If all the staging investigations are clear, then we may elect to do surgery up front, or we may elect to give neoadjuvant chemotherapy up front. So the instances where we may refer our patients to our oncology colleagues to give neoadjuvant chemotherapy are women who have triple negative breast cancers, women who have a HER2-positive breast cancer, women with large breast cancers, to try and treat the individual before surgery, because what we do know is from studies that these women benefit from having chemotherapy up front and being treated systemically for their disease and then having surgery after that. Women who have small breast cancers, small invasive breast cancers, we can certainly offer a wide local excision. And we may not necessarily do an axillary clearance. If there are no known nodal metastases at the time of diagnosis, we would offer a central node biopsy. And when I say that, it's a special test where some dye is injected on the morning of surgery or the day before surgery, and also potentially dye injected at the time of surgery to detect one or a few lymph nodes which the breast cancer will drain to. And so these nodes are the sentinel nodes, or the gatekeeper nodes, which would filter out any tumour cells. And by doing that particular test, it means that we don't have to do a full axillary clearance by taking out all the lymph glands from under the armpit to test whether a woman has metastatic disease in her lymph nodes under in the axilla or not. Because what we know is most women don't have metastatic disease in their axilla at the time of diagnosis. So by doing the smaller operation, we can reduce the complications of having surgery to the axilla, namely lymphedema, numbness to the chest wall and under the arm, the problems with potential risk of shoulder stiffness, particularly if a woman has a pre-existing shoulder condition, and also just in the short-term post-operative period, the risk of getting a pocket of fluid under the armpit where the surgical site is much higher if you've had a full axillary clearance than if you've had a sentinel node because you've done a bigger operation.
So if the sentinel nodes come back clear, whether or not they've had neoadjuvant therapy, would you then combine it with oncological treatment afterwards, or would you just leave it at the surgical treatment?
So if the sentinel nodes come back clear, it will really depend on the tumour characteristics. So if the primary tumour is large, then the oncologist will still want to see the patient. If they have a luminal B or a HER2-positive cancer or a triple-negative cancer, then they'll want to have a chat with the patient. So it's not quite as clear-cut as it used to be, but that's really good because what it means is that the treatments being offered to patients are being very individualised. If the patient has an estrogen receptor positive tumour, then we would always offer them anti-estrogen therapy for 5 to 10 years. And if a woman has had a breast-conserving operation, then we would strongly recommend that she have adjuvant radiotherapy treatment to reduce the risk of local recurrence.
Basically, if you leave it as a lumpectomy, they would have adjuvant radiotherapy just to reduce the risk of local recurrence. The alternative option is to go for mastectomies and then reconstruction at a later stage.
That's correct. So there are some patients, particularly those from the country, who don't want to come down for 3 to 5 weeks in the city for adjuvant radiotherapy, or some patients who adjuvant radiotherapy is contraindicated in, a mastectomy may be recommended.
So there's a lot for a person to go through with initial diagnosis than the
I'd like to let you know that AussieMedEd is supported by HealthShare. HealthShare is a digital health company that provides solutions for patients, GPs and specialists across Australia. Two of HealthShare's products are Better Consult, a pre-consultation questionnaire that allows GPs to know a patient's agenda before the consult begins, as well as HealthShare's Specialist Referrals Directory, a specialist and allied health directory helping GPs find the right specialist.
Aging after the fine needle or the core biopsy, then the neoadjuvant treatment, then the surgery, and then the oncological treatment afterwards. How long does such a treatment take?
At the absolute shortest, probably about 3 months if a woman just requires surgery and radiotherapy. But if the woman does need neoadjuvant or adjuvant chemotherapy, then it will be a much longer course of treatment. And if she then needs Herceptin treatment, that's a 12-month course of treatment.
So obviously during this difficult period, there's a lot of psychological impact on the patient's well-being. I believe there's nurses and other psychologists they can turn to help for support during this difficult time.
Yeah, and also don't forget the individual's GP. Our GP colleagues are really great at managing these things as well. So I think it's really important to get everyone involved at the beginning and let the individual know that there are supports out in the community. As you mentioned, we've got amazing breast care nurses throughout the country now. There are also oncology nurses, GPs, psychologists with an interest in cancer diagnoses and dealing with cancer. Also, the Cancer Council of Australia has a helpline as well with trained counsellors as well. So there are lots of supports out there. And in my role as a surgeon who deals with breast cancer, I certainly let my patients know that there are resources out there. They just have to let someone know what's going on and then we can tap into those resources for them.
What sort of oncology treatment is there? Is it immunotherapy? Is it all the tamoxifen and estrogen reduction? Or is it a combination of necrotizing type agents as well?
So, Gavin, it's interesting that you mentioned immunotherapy because that's certainly being researched quite heavily. At this point in time, it is purely in breast cancer being done in trials. For a woman who has early breast cancer, we wouldn't treat them with immunotherapy. But as we know with all drugs, in research, it's usually the patients who have late-stage disease who are treated with those medications, and if they're found to be beneficial and safe to be used in humans, then drug companies will then look to receive ethics approval to then run trials for women with earlier and earlier stages. And the example that I give you is the role of Herceptin for women with HER2-positive breast cancer. It was initially only for women with metastatic breast cancer, and it was very expensive when it came in, $70,000 plus for a course of treatment. And then trials emerged where it showed that Herceptin was significantly beneficial in women with HER2-positive breast cancer, with early breast cancer, and now it is standard treatment. But without those trials and the lobbying of surgeons, oncologists and survivors of breast cancer, we wouldn't have had it put on the PBS back in the early 2000s.
So that's one of the more common medications now, is it? How does that one actually work?
So Herceptin is medication which works on the HER2 receptor, which is a growth receptor. And if your breast cancer is HER2 positive, then it will attach to the hormone receptor, it will attach to the HER2 receptor on any circulating tumour cells or tumour cells in the body to then stop that growth pathway. So it's a targeted therapy which has been shown to significantly reduce the risk of metastatic breast cancer in women who have early breast cancer that is known as HER2-positive breast cancer. It's given as an injection, but also can be given as a subcutaneous dosing as well now in certain instances.
And apart from that one, and tamoxifen still used as well, is it?
Yes, so tamoxifen was the first estrogen receptor antagonist. Tamoxifen is still one of the commonly prescribed anti-estrogen medications. It attaches to the estrogen receptors selectively on breast cells to work as an antagonist to stop the promotion of growth and to stop estrogen from attaching to those cells. And it's particularly useful in premenopausal women because their ovaries are still working and they still have high levels of estrogen in their blood circulation. We also have aromatase inhibitors, which work by preventing the formation of estrogen by the enzyme aromatase. So that's the peripheral production of estrogen, so the non-ovarian production of estrogen in postmenopausal women and men as well. And we know that aromatase inhibitors do have a slightly better rate of reduction of recurrence of breast cancer or a second breast cancer in a woman, but it can only be used in postmenopausal women or premenopausal women who have ovarian suppression. So they're the two types of anti-estrogen therapies which are used in women who have estrogen receptor positive breast cancer.
What about cytotoxic drugs? Do they use those as well?
So cytotoxic drugs, being chemotherapy, are used in instances where it would be of benefit. So if you had a small early breast cancer, the risk of complications from chemotherapy versus the very, very tiny benefit of giving it, because your cancer is so good that you're unlikely to have metastatic disease in your lifetime, you just wouldn't offer it to the individual. So that's the luminal A type of breast cancers.
So more metastatic type disease, or the ones at high risk of metastatic disease. And radiotherapy? Is radiotherapy just used to prevent recurrence, or is it also used for treatment as well?
We would use radiotherapy to prevent recurrence. So if you had a wide local excision, or in the setting of where a woman had a mastectomy but had a high-risk breast cancer for local recurrence. We also use radiotherapy in the setting of metastatic disease, where a woman might have a metastasis which is symptomatic in her spine, for example, or in one of her long bones. And very rarely do we see cases of locally advanced breast cancer where the tumour is fungating, and if the individual can't have surgery for whatever reason, radiotherapy may be indicated, or if there is a recurrence of breast cancer in the skin in a woman who has had a mastectomy, it may be considered. But these are pretty rare occurrences, and those scenarios will be discussed in a multidisciplinary meeting to try and work out what the best plan of attack is to deal with the individual situation.
That's excellent. I think we've gone through a lot here today. We've gone through the types of cancers and how they present and with their receptors. We've gone through the associations and prevention and screening. We've gone through the differential diagnosis and then the early investigations, and then the staging and then the treatment. So we've covered what I wanted to cover today. Perhaps I could finish off by asking you what you think the future holds with breast cancer treatment.
I think the future is really good for breast cancer, because we have so many treatment options available for women, but also, as I mentioned, immunotherapy is on the horizon, and as these agents are being developed, we'll probably have more drugs that we can use to treat breast cancer or to prevent breast cancer from causing metastatic disease. So hopefully in my lifetime, surgery might be phased out, but I guess we'll have to watch the horizon.
Well, it's fantastic having you on board. Thank you very much for coming on AussieMed today. It's excellent. Dr. Christine Lai, and we really appreciate your expertise in this area. And thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks very much for having me on, Gavin. It's been a real honour and pleasure to chat with you today.
The information provided to you today is designed to complement the information provided to you in your local region and should supplement your readings and teachings in that area. Please don't take it as the only way of treating this condition or assessing a condition, but really as one of various ways of assessing these conditions. Please be aware that the information provided today is really just general medical advice and isn't designed to actually be a source of medical information regarding your particular condition. Remember to consult your specialist or medical practitioner if you have concerns about a condition raised in this podcast. Well, thanks once again for listening to our podcast, AussieMedEd, or the Australian Medical Education Podcast. We really enjoy hosting this podcast. I hope you find it useful to hear a pragmatic approach to everyday conditions. If you have any questions or information you want to ask about us, or you'd like to put a suggestion for a topic, please don't hesitate to email us at gavin@med-ed.com.au. Once again, I hope you've enjoyed listening to it, and we look forward to hosting it next fortnight when we introduce a new topic. Thank you.